In this reel of Seawell Movies, Carlos joins us again as we journey back into the past to take a look at the 1962 movie that put the epic in epic, Lawrence of Arabia. Does the majesty of the film translate through the years, or is the grandeur lost on today's smaller screens and modern audiences? Next, we take a slightly convoluted journey into the present by looking at Disney's re-release of the Studio Ghibli film, The Secret World of Arrietty. Do the boys all fall under the warm and fuzzy spell of Miyazaki-san? Finally, the boys jump into the undefined future for a look at the bizarre, crazy, and chaotic John Dies at the End. Does this trailer grab us despite all the chaos, or does it intrigue us? All that plus news about Prometheus, Johnny Depp with a bird on his head, an Avengers sequel, and more on this 95th reel of Seawell Movies. Hut, hut, hut!
The past.
You telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
The present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
The future.
Hi. Welcome to the future.
And I'm telling you, it's great here.
You're listening to COL Movies.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a brand spanking new edition of COL Movies. This is reel number 95. My name is Jeff, and I would like to introduce my undisciplined, unpunctual, and untidy co-hosts, Ray and Carlos. How are you guys doing today?
How dare you?
I object to some of that, but I won't tell you what.
Okay. Got a lot of quotes from a movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's, one thing I'd like to say is I am very proud of myself about our brand spanking new website theme. Doesn't it look pretty?
Yeah.
Yes.
Same great taste, just new packaging.
Yes.
Right.
It looks shiny. I like it. I'm proud of myself. Anyways, on to the news.
News on the mark.
Teenager petitions to change R rating for Bully.
Yep. So there's a documentary that's coming out called Bully, obviously. That has gotten slapped with an R rating by the MPAA for language, of all things. And this is a documentary that sort of tracks victims and perpetrators of sort of bullying in American schools. So it's really sort of, you know, bullying has been a really hot topic lately. It's kind of interesting that this film sort of popped up on the radar. And so there's this teenager, Katie Butler, who has taken it as a crusade to try to get a petition going to get the MPAA to reduce the rating from an R to a PG-13 in the hopes that more young people will be able to see it. From what I can tell, there's been, you know, screenings of the film, and there's a lot of people that are just like, you know, the language that's in this film is really nothing worse than what kids hear every day or use every day. So I find it interesting that there's this huge struggle about this. I didn't even know or heard anything about this documentary at all. And I'm kind of surprised with the amount of bullying in the news and media lately that I haven't heard about this. What about you guys?
It kind of pisses me off in one way, only because it kind of reinforces again and again that the rating system does not make any sense.
I agree.
It is geared towards things that a very small percentage of people care about and that no one else cares anything at all about. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that they're wanting to give an R rating is because of language, you know, whereas, hey, let's go shoot somebody's face off. And that's fine. But language and actually being uncomfortable about the language is enough to give it an R rating. I'm not usually a big fan on the idea that rating should be geared towards encouraging people to see it. You know, a PG-13 movie shouldn't encourage 13-year-olds to go see it. The movie itself will either be something 13-year-olds want to watch or something they don't want to watch. But it should be the rating should be indicative of what kind of movie it is and what things are in it. So if you're going to give it an R rating, don't do it because you want to keep 13-year-olds away from it. Do it because you want to describe what's in it, which is language, which we'll all just get all pissy about at the end.
Right.
Well, for me, it's I think of it in two different perspectives. One, you know, the MPAA is trying to do have this rating system, and they don't. While there is some subjectivity to it, they still basically have a checklist. Okay, right. So they say fuck 15 times during this movie. Okay, that's an R rating qualification, and there's this, that, and the other. So based off of these certain criteria, they say that is the criteria for R rating, and if they say it's like, well, if we reduce this one, well, then we have to look at all those other ones that we're rating at R rating and being it be reduced, and when it should or shouldn't be, and you're getting into more subjective view versus trying to be slightly objective. I mean, in any case, it's subjective, but they still have some sort of objective criteria when they're doing these ratings. On the other hand, you also have to look at this is the MPAA's rating. There's this a recommended rating that based off of, you know, as I said, criteria and some subjectivity, but also it means that, hey, you know, shouldn't also parents be seeing this movie too? Mm-hmm. And you know, if a parent takes their kids to an R-rated movie, especially if it's called Bully, that shouldn't be a problem at all. Well, so it's also dealing with the parents having to have that idea. The only problem is now we get over to where the parents fail in being like, oh, it's rated R. They shouldn't be seeing this movie at all. But just because it's a rated R movie doesn't mean it's not something that a 14, 15-year-old shouldn't see, because especially in the case of Bully. So we get kind of this catch-22 between how we should be rating movies, because I do believe that the rating system has a use to it, but it also, on the other hand, it's the parents dealing with knowing what their kids are going to see and being okay with it. And if they want them to see it or if they don't want them to see it. So
right.
It's going back and forth between the two, and it's a catch-22.
The thing for me, like I grew up, you know, long before the PG-13 rating came along. And in my parents' eyes, if a movie was rated R, that meant that it was unsuitable for children to watch. If you were not 18, you should not go see. I mean, they were pretty hardline about that. And my parents were not the ones that would be like, oh, because if I had kids, I would be like, all right, here's this R-rated movie. I'm going to go see it myself. Go watch it and then decide whether or not I think my children should see it. And then if I do, then I'm going to take them and we'll go see it together. But, you know, there are some people that, you know, and some parents that will just be like, if it's R, I'm not even going to consider taking my children to see it, as crazy as it sounds. But there's a lot of that goes on. I agree with Carlos that the MPAA is honestly, I know you're saying that it's like, you know, they have these rules where if they say, you know, this word so many times, then it's getting a rating. That means that I can make a documentary about 10-year-olds with Tourette's that go to Disney World, and it could get an R rating because the kids medically can't stop themselves from swearing more than 15 times in the movie. Mm-hmm. It just seems kind of silly sometimes when you look at it that way.
I mean, I do think ratings are important. I always think ratings should be. I just think that they're so focused on this one aspect, language, that the majority of the world doesn't give a shit about. And so it becomes myopic, but obviously ratings are important. I just wish that they cared about the right things.
Mm-hmm. There's times when I almost wish that instead of just giving like, hey, and I know they do it now where they say, you know, this is rated R because of, you know, language, nudity, blah, 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 blah. This is why I almost wish that they would almost quantify it and say, this is rated R because, you know, there are this many expletives in the movie, you know, 15 people die violently. You know what I mean? Like, actually break it down. Give me some quantifiable things that say this is why it's R. Sure.
We also have to talk about the other aspects of ratings, in the sense that it also changes how you can advertise the movie and how you can package the movie. So, you know, like, really that's an issue for NC-17, where you can't have TV commercials for it. You can't have posters with it. But R rating, I'm wondering, can they advertise it on Saturday afternoon? Can they do it as an after school special? Can they do it on the Disney Channel? Can you advertise an R rating in those movies, in those venues? So although a part of me says rating doesn't matter because it's going to be on Netflix, it's going to be on YouTube, it's going to be on Netflix, it's going to be torrented, it's going to be elsewhere where ratings don't matter, it may not have a very big effect if it stays R-rated versus if it's PG-13, it can have a very wide release that people see it all at the same time. But it's an issue not of the subject of this particular movie, which obviously is a very important documentary that people should see for many reasons. I mean, I do get annoyed that this movie is getting kind of hurt by this issue, but it's a much larger issue. This was an issue with South Park, the musical in 94, 96, 97, 98, somewhere in there. I mean, this was an issue for a very long time that the rating system has this blind spot in nonviolent, very language-heavy movies that fall into this nether region. And maybe it's going to be like it was in 84 between PG and R, that, you know, Temple of Doom came around and created the, you know, the Raiders of, and we talked about that in Gremlins, created the PG-13 rating, where it's like, hey, there's a big hole here. But it'd be nice if there was a rating that said, like Ray is saying, it's rated R for language, which is different than rated R for violence. We treat those differently. We think of them differently so that we don't pull them all with the horrible sex comedy R, because that's the thing. It's hard to think of Bully on the same level as, say, Knocked Up. I mean, or the Superbad. I mean, it's hard to say that these movies should be treated the same. I mean, that's just a big hammer for a really small thing.
Or maybe they need to do combo ratings. So PG-13R.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you think about, like, you know, even recently when you have movies like The King's Speech, which won Academy Awards. And when it went back into theaters, they actually, you know, censored it and edited it so that they could drop the rating down to PG-13 so they could have a wider release.
And it's all because of one damn scene. It's one damn moment that works because he curses in it, and it works because it's cursing in it.
Right.
I got it all apoplectic at that moment.
Yeah, it's not gratuitous at all. You know, it's part of
what he's swearing for a reason.
He's swearing for a reason, and it's funny.
So I just wanted to put this on here to make sure if there's anybody that's listening, you know, I'm a big person on documentaries, and I'm definitely going to check this out. So I wanted to see if I wanted to help it get a little bit of exposure from our show to make sure that it was out there and that people go see it. So
elite project.com. is the website, as well as the rating change petition is chn.ge, so it's almost like change, /ZD9ERW. We'll put that link in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Moving on, more Prometheus news.
Yes.
Oh, the geek ratcheted up early. The geek response to this movie is off the charts. I haven't seen people get this hard up about it since Tron.
Yeah, I know. And
like every shot needs to be analyzed.
This is, again, now normally, like, when I see a movie trailer or something advertised that it's going to be an IMAX 3D, it doesn't really do much for me. Like, I'm like, okay.
Yeah, whatever.
For some reason, though, this is a movie that I would see in IMAX 3D. And if you have any, the IMAX 3D theater at my local theater here is one that if you're unfortunate enough to be seeing a movie in the theater next to it, the whole wall vibrates while the other movie is playing in the other rooms. It's like, oh my God, what is going on in there?
Yeah, us city folk don't quite get that.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So,
and you know how much of a fan of IMAX I really am. here's the thing: is for this movie, I'll go see it in IMAX 3D. I found out that the one in the AMC's has an IMAX, but I'm afraid that it might be in LIMAX, where it's not the right resolution for what they're trying to shoot for versus, you know, the regular non-digital IMAX. I don't know if it's all digital IMAX that's LIMAX or if it's just some which are just reformatting the picture to fit in an IMAX size screen.
Well, according to IMAX and 20th Century Fox, they put in a press release They said Prometheus, the summer's scariest action event picture, and director Ridley Scott's return to the genre he helped define, which is going to be the tagline for this movie, I swear to God, will be digitally remastered into the immersive IMAX 3D format and released in IMAX digital and film theaters domestically.
Yeah, that means they're up-converting it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means they're up-converting it from what they shot it in. I mean, I like watching IMAX if you're shooting it in 65mm. If you're actually shooting it on an IMAX camera, then it actually gains. Sometimes it rocks. Dark Knight didn't rock for me, but Speed Racer did rock for me in IMAX. Avatar did rock for me in IMAX. If you shoot it in IMAX, it works. Now, obviously, up-converting is a very broad, vague term, and sometimes it's done beautifully, but it's almost like the 3D after the fact. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's piss. So it go either way. But that being said, I will go see this movie wherever I can get a large group of people to go see this movie with me, because I do believe it needs to be one of those sort of all-together midnight showings kind of things.
I guess I have enough faith in Ridley that I would hope that he would not allow it to be. I mean, I know he only has so much control over the distribution of the film, but I would just hope that he would have some say in, like, okay, they're going to do a good job, I'm going to let them do it. You know what I mean? Like, or he would speak out about
it. He's not exactly James Cameron, but you think he might play a little bit of a role.
I will tell you this for certain. This will be the last IMAX movie I probably will ever see unless they really impress me with that, because I'm definitely not going to the IMAX theater at the museum, which was our only IMAX theater.
Yeah,
I'm going to the actual, but I'm going to the AMC IMAX, which I have doubts about because of what I've heard of IMAX, and unless I get a really amazing experience, I am never going to see an IMAX movie again. Yeah. Everything is going to be at the Alamo Drafthouse. Sorry.
I do believe that you do suffer from not having a true IMAX theater. That, I mean, I get the Navy Pier IMAX theater, which is pretty good, but if I drive around a little bit, I can get to something on the level of what Ray gets. But it really does make a difference where you're watching it at. Doing a little reading myself, it appears that the movie was shot on Red Epic digital cameras. So those things shoot at really high resolutions to begin with, much higher than a normal 35mm. So you may not have, yeah, they do 8K. So I didn't want to get too technical because I don't know how technical you guys get. there could be something to be said that this process of upconverting them to IMAX won't detract very much. Also, another issue that gets really pissed off when you go to IMAX 3D is that they don't, at least with IMAX 3D, they usually will project it at the right light setting, whereas if you go to a standard 3D, it can be pretty dark. So that here, when it's $16-$20, it really is difficult to gauge whether you should do it or not, because it's often not worth it. But if you can find an IMAX 3D theater that you really like, $16, $17, $18 is totally worth it.
The only true IMAX theater I know here in Austin is the one at the museum.
Sure.
And that is the worst movie watching experience ever. Sure, I'll sit there and watch a 20-minute short documentary of whales swimming in the ocean, but I'm not gonna sit in there. I sat in there for Dark Knight, and that semi spoiled my experience because I was so not comfortable with it. So that's why I'm definitely going to try this AMC one and hoping it's going to be fine.
Also, for folks who may not really know what we talk about when we say good IMAX, there are a couple of things you do need to keep in mind. One, you have to be able to sit in it and not be able to see the edges of the screen. It has to kind of wrap around you a little bit. You know, it has to the point where you have to lean back in your seat to catch the upper sections. The vibrating of the walls, people keep calling it surround sound, but it's something extra special where you feel like the entire room is filled with the sound. Those are kind of important things. We're talking 4 or 5-story screens wrapping around and sort of like it has to have an epic feeling to it. Do not go to an AMC theater somewhere that one of their screens is IMAX, because that doesn't work.
Right.
Okay, so then I'm not going to see this movie in IMAX.
No, and it's actually a problem because they'll advertise it as IMAX, but there are varying grades of it. It's like that old THX thing. It's like, are we talking good THX or just kind of THX? It really does make a difference.
Yes, it does.
I've lost faith in IMAX.
You should. Thank you very much.
I mean, The thing is, when you get the good stuff, it's good stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
It's totally marketing. It's like 4G LTE. You kind of have to know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Versus HSPA. The other 4G.
Yeah,
4G. Both of those are a little bit of quotes for 4G.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, Alrighty. That's our rant about IMAX and RIMAX.
And next up, a picture of Johnny Depp as Tonto and Armie Hammer as the Lone Ranger. Moving on.
Yeah, I it's difficult for me to talk about this. I'm like, really? Am I really okay with Johnny Depp as Tonto? I mean, how does that get away with that? How do you?
It's Captain Jack Sparrow with a bird on his head.
Great. Well, and no beard.
Yeah, well.
So as I said, moving on.
I mean,
he's an Indian. They don't have beards.
He's painted white and black as if he's like a weird Robert Smith wannabe. This is, it's The Crow. It's Johnny Depp and The Crow.
Yeah. Well, you know, they had to hide how obviously white Johnny Depp is by painting his face. So, I don't know. I just thought it was funny. It's the first time I've ever actually seen him in character. And we talked about this long, long, long ago when we first heard, you know, rumors that he was going to be playing Tonto. And I don't even remember what our reaction was. I know mine was, I just hope he's not going to regurgitate, you know, Jack Sparrow from Pirates of the Caribbean. No,
I think he's not going to play this drunk.
No, but I don't know. There's some similarities there. So it'll be interesting to see what he does. When the first trailer comes out, we'll have to take a look at it.
But, I mean, if anyone could get away with it, it's Johnny Depp, but you're like going into like really scary territory where you start playing like a Native American with a bird on your head.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like the Tropic Thunder Robert Downey Jr. playing him in blackface and making that work somehow.
It's parody. It's parody.
Is the movie really work? I mean, that's the thing. Is the from reading about the movie, which I've done a new reading over the last couple of weeks about the movie because I was curious, it appears that it's going to be an action film. There's no real sort of like edge to it in that sense. So, you know, we're just supposed to take him as Tonto without any winking? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's all. Hopefully he won't go full Native American because you never go full Native American.
Yeah, that's all I want to talk about that. I just wanted to throw it out there so people could see what he looks like. I'm hopefully going to post the picture up on the website and on our Facebook, see if we can get some people's opinions. But moving on, the next one, and this is another one. This is, you know, this summer seems to be just full of geekiness. So we've got The Avengers. We're a little about 2 months away before The Avengers hit.
I'm still coming because of that trailer.
And of course, we're already talking about sequels for a movie that hasn't even hit yet. So somebody posed a question to Mr. Whedon about, they were talking about the first film, obviously, and then a potential sequel. And I loved what he had to say about them, talking about, like, he wants to know what makes these people tick because he believes they're all essentially flawed. What makes them flawed? What makes them fight? Ultimately, what makes them awesome is what he's quoted as saying. And then when they go, they talk about, you know, well, if you were going to make a sequel, how could you make the sequel bigger than this? Or, you know, this already film that's not even out yet has got such hype behind it. And everybody's expecting it to be awesome, and the trailer looked great, and it just kind of helped roll this movie into this giant ball of, I don't know what to call it. But so they're talking about, he goes, well, he kind of took another direction, and they go, what can you do to make the sequel any bigger? And he goes, by not trying to. Making it smaller, more personal, more painful, which would be really interesting if he was allowed to do that. I think that would be really interesting, although I don't know how audiences would react. Are superhero audiences ready for a smaller, more personal, more painful, anguish-filled superhero movie?
I would say yes. I would say that I've been waiting for this for a while. I always said that the superhero genre will mature when we have movies with superheroes in them, not superhero movies. That when we have enough superhero movies that some of them can go on different directions. And I think we've done that. Hancock Chronicle, even Ghost Rider in some weird, creepy way, are all really? Various types of superhero. I mean, they don't have to be good. Punisher, both Punishers, Blade. These are all movies that are at various scales. Superhero movies don't have to all be Superman. They don't have to be The Dark Knight. They can be little movies. Like I would like to see, it's appropriate for the kind of characters they are. A Black Widow movie is a spy movie. Who cares if it's Black Widow? It's just a spy movie. So that's important. Also, I think that it translates really well to what comics do. I mean, a large part of what brought Avengers to much prominence, although Avengers have been popular for a very long time, is what folks in the Ultimate Universe did with Avengers, where they turned it into this hugely epic thing in a way that is hard to describe unless you have read them, that, you know, at some point of your reading of the Avengers, the pages open up, so there's like a 9-panel panorama of what's going on. You know, it's epic, but there are 3 or 4 other Avenger books that are about smaller characters doing smaller things. I always said, if you have a good story, it doesn't matter what size it is or who's in it, it's a good story that people will pay attention to. That being said, if you're going to make a Black Widow movie, make sure it costs $30 million to make. Don't make a $90 million, $200 million Black Widow movie, because you're going to lose money. But a $30 million Black Widow movie, a Hawkeye movie where he's in a jungle somewhere, you know, some weird, creepy crossover with Hawkeye and Green Arrow end up having to win money somewhere. I just thought that off my head.
Difficult.
Basically, when we get out of the mindset that every superhero movie needs to be this $150, $200 million epic, then I think we've arrived. Like, when you're able to pull off the $30 million, you know, superhero movie that we're talking about, then I think we're at that level.
The only thing is, if they did a Black Widow spy movie, it better not be too sexy. I really would like to just see one of those kick-ass girl movies again. I'd love those.
Ultraviolet kind of movie,
I mean, she's not James Bond. But she can kick ass.
But it happens in every other genre. You know, there are various type of mystery movies, action movies, you know, versus the Vin Diesel action movie or the George Clooney action movie. It happens in every genre. You can have variation across the board, and everything has its own different goals and necessities and so on. But you have to kind of get past that one thing that a lot of people have a hard time getting past, of a superhero movie being a summer tentpole movie. Hopefully, if Joss Whedon decides that, you know, I'm done with Avengers, I have enough money, I'm going to go make my Black Widow movie where she's a kick-ass person. Someone will give him $30 million to do that, and then Kevin Smith can go off and make a Green Arrow movie and not have to fulfill the needs of a studio saying, give me a franchise, give me 12 movies and $3 billion. You know, I think that's a nice way to go, but we as an audience have to, you know, go to those movies and enjoy them just as much, you know, but...
Yes.
I have a question about Avengers, though. Is this really, you think this might be the biggest, most epic movie we've ever seen? I can't imagine a movie that has this much bigness to it. I mean, five heroes, invasion, like two gods going at it with the Hulk in between. It's a scale that's hard to sort of really get your arms around.
Well, I can't help but think, too, that the way that Marvel has chosen to release these films, as far as, you know, everybody got their own movie to help sort of like, let's get everybody familiar and on board with these characters. Because we know when you say you're making an Avengers movie or you're making an Iron Man movie, you've got a built-in audience as long as you don't do too much to piss off the diehards. You know, you've got a built-in audience, especially with the sort of track run Marvel's had lately. You know, they've been doing a really good job of, you know, translating their material to the screen without making it too cheesy, keeping it, you know, realistic to a degree. So I think they've done a really good job as far as, yes, you've automatically got a built-in crazy geek audience when you say, I'm making an Avengers movie. But by rolling out all these hero movies one by one, you've also got you've grabbed onto the non-comic book geek person that maybe they were aware of the Avengers but weren't really aware of all of the little parts that go into it. So now they're like, you mean all these guys are going to be in a movie together? That's awesome. You know, like, so yeah. I think that's helped. We've done a little, you know, Katamari here with superheroes and just rolled it up into this giant ball of awesome that's going to explode on the screen.
Yeah. I really try to be impartial about this, but I don't know how you can be.
Right.
At some point, Hulk is knocking out a rocket ship and saving Iron Man and flying down a building. I mean, it's hard to really imagine what this is going to be like.
You just saw the best parts of the movie. here's the thing.
I think he's saving something for us.
About this, and, you know, I watched the trailer. I'm like, ooh, like really excited about this movie. I'll tell you this: I'm going to go see this movie. I'm probably going to love the movie absolutely. But I have this fear that it's going to be a meh movie. No. It's going to be like, sure, it was really really fun, but Transformers level. Ouch.
I don't think I have more faith in Transformers.
That's what I'm afraid of. We got Joss Whedon, so that there's potential there. I'm just fearing so much that this is just going to fail from being this intriguing movie that's going to like be 2.5 hours long, and I would be completely and utterly satisfied with a fun actiony movie that lasts an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. But I mean, hopefully that would also be a disappointment to me because, as you said, it feels so epic. The only thing is, I don't think it's going to be. It's going to have these epic battles and everything, but so did Transformers. I'm sorry.
No, but, I think it's important to set an expectation. I mean, I think sometimes we forget that The Dark Knight is a huge epic movie, but it's also an incredibly good, well-made movie. And so very rarely can we get movies that are as good as, say, Dark Knight. But that being said, Transformers is a horrible movie. It's horrible on many, many levels. It is almost a failure of filmmaking in some ways. My favorite one was Roger Ebert saying, it's like watching two swarms of bees go at it. Like, you really don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but what's that?
And so there, it's that. You can have, if this is a competent, well-made action movie, it's going to be awesome. And yes. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to wake up 5 years from later and go, I need to go watch The Dark Knight again. You know, so there is space between horrible Transformers and epic, you know, instant classic. I think we have a lot of way to go, and I think we'll be happy with wherever it lands in that timeline. But please don't be Transformers, because that will really piss me off.
Well, I mean, my one hope is that even on when Joss Whedon's having a not so fantastic day, you know, he doesn't, everything the dude turns out is not gold. You know, he has some rough edges there, but even his rough edges typically are more entertaining than a lot of people's failures. So that's my one saving grace in all this, that I know that even if it's not as epic and as great as everybody's hoping it's going to be, I'm hoping that at least it's going to be a decent film to watch, you know?
There's also a marketing side.
The invasion's only going to last about 20 minutes. It's going to be the last in the movie that we're going to see everything. Well, that was a wrap or something from Tony at the end.
Pacing-wise, it'll be interesting because, you know, some would argue you don't have to really get started because we've had four movies, you know, between Thor, Iron Man, Captain America, and some of the Hulk stuff. We've had four movies where we don't need really a prologue. So, you know, I'm guessing that we could have Loki invade halfway through the movie. I mean, look at Transformers 3, for instance. Transformers 3, they invade Chicago, and I looked at my watch. I'm like, there's like a half hour left. What are they going to go from here? And then, so, I mean, pacing will be interesting. I don't think it'll be a 2.5 hour movie. I do believe that we'll get in, we'll have some fun times, crazy stuff will happen, it'll get resolved, and then we'll be told to stay tuned for the next round.
Yeah, maybe we're going to have something that they did pretty much set everything up in the previous movies. So we get in, Captain America's being briefed as to, yes, you're now in 2010, and here's what's going on. By the way, we need your help. We're we're detecting that this alien invasion is coming, so we need you. They get everybody together. We're about halfway into the movie. Loki invades.
Yeah. Well, I do believe that they're going to do some things about how these people don't like each other. Like, these people are used to not working together, because that's the Avengers. That's kind of an Avengers credo, that they all have to figure out why they need each other. So that'll be interesting to see. But, I mean, we'll see. We don't even know what the plot of this damn movie is, so it's hard to figure out what the pacing will be. But, again, it comes down to trust. Trust that Joss Whedon will both write and direct an effective two-hour action movie that won't make us cry.
I want is another Incredible Hulk movie, and it better be Ruffalo, so they at least stay with the same guy for two movies in a row.
Yeah. I'm a weirdo. I'm fairly fond of the Ang Lee movie, but
You know what? I enjoyed the Ang Lee movie too,
except for the end.
I like that they reboot it though, I thought Edward Norton did a great job. Would have liked to see him in this movie, but hey, if they're gonna have Ruffalo, keep Ruffalo, please. Just keep him.
Does anyone? I didn't. This is a piece I didn't know. Why did Ed Norton? Oh, Ed Norton just didn't want to do the movie, or didn't he want to get paid right?
I think he just didn't want to do it. I think he was sort of like, you know, I did my Hulk movie. He was one of those like, that's my Hulk movie, and I'm okay with that.
I remember now. He hated it because they edited the Hulk movie in a way he didn't like. He felt like they changed what he did, and he's kind of a bit of an asshole about that. He's a big old artist, so I think he just got upset that he didn't want to work with them anymore.
Gotcha.
But anyway, we all know what we're going to do on that day, and I'm sure I know every geek I know is going to be there on that day. I can't wait for the opening weekend gross. It's gonna be huge. Yeah. It's gonna be mammoth huge, because one's gonna wait. No geek is gonna wait at all.
All right. So we're talking a lot here. Yes. Should we go on to the next story? Or should we just move into the past?
The next story is really quick. Okay. You don't really need to talk about it. I just saw this in the headlines and I laughed my ass off when I read the story. So of course you've got Stallone and Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger's now, you know, no longer the governator, so he's able to go back into films. And I don't know if Stallone and Schwarzenegger are like the new Corey Haim, Corey Feldman duo or what's not, but they can't seem to now make movies without each other. So they're talking to them about what their next films are. Now, I didn't even really get to the Arnold part of the story because I read the first quote from Stallone and I just was like, I can't believe that he actually said this. So he goes, I'm dying to do another Rambo. He's in Arizona on the border. It will involve him going into Mexico. I don't think Rambo likes Mexicans. And I was like, really? I want to see Rambo versus Machete.
That's what I'm nice.
I'd watch that. Hilarious.
I want to watch that.
It's got to be in the whole Grindhouse style if they do. It's got to be.
Yeah. I didn't even get to, I mean, they're talking about Expendables 2 and The Tomb and some other couple of movies that they've been working on, and Arnold talking about doing stunts. And I was like, really? Is he still going to do his own stunts? I mean, more power to him if he is, but.
Yes.
But yeah, that's all I want to know is apparently Rambo does not like Mexicans. So.
All right. With that,
Charles, good to know.
With that, let's move into the past.
You telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Lawrence of Arabia, 98% fresh, 91% audience, directed by David Lean, starring Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, and Anthony Quinn. Damn, this was a long movie. This is like, it was like 2 weeks ago that we had Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind.
4 hours, which was longer than this, I believe. But damn, this is a long movie. And, you know, one thing I liked about Gone with the Wind, at least when they had their overtures and entr'actes, there was something on the screen, but hey.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't fall asleep on this one, though. That's
good. I didn't make, well, it's not because the movie put me to sleep, but I've had a really crazy week because my mom's been in the hospital and I've been working crazy hours, and so I like almost didn't think I was going to have time to watch this movie. So as a precaution, I had set it up to rip the disc and put it on my iPad because I knew yesterday I was going to be at the hospital for at least 3 or 4 hours. So I'm like, I'm going to rip it, put it on my iPad, and if I'm sitting in the waiting room, I can just, you know, watch some of the movie or whatnot. So I let my laptop do its thing and put it on the iPad and didn't even check to see how the rip came out. And then I got to the hospital and, you know, got settled in and pulled my iPad out, started watching it. And so, of course, I press play and music starts and no image. And I'm like, okay, is this on purpose or not on purpose? I'm like, I was really confused for a minute because, again, you know, as modern film audiences, we're not used to the whole, you know, entrance, overture, intermission sort of thing going on. So I didn't see any of the stuff that's on this DVD that said, hey, the beginning of this movie, the director refused to have any image shown during the first 2.5 minutes while the music was playing. So don't freak out. You know, your DVD is fine. I didn't have that disclaimer because a Handbrake didn't put that on my rip. So I was a little confused at first. It took me a couple, then I'm like, okay, it looks like it's fine. All right. So, but yeah, that was my interesting first foray into it. I ended up not being able to watch it at the hospital because I'm like, if I sit here and watch this here, I'm going to fall asleep. So I ended up watching the first 3 hours of it when I got home from the hospital. But by the time I got to the 3 hour mark, it was like 10:30 and I'm like, I gotta be up at 3:30 in the morning. So I'm going to cut it here and watch the rest of it tomorrow after work. So I finished it up today. I finished the last 45 minutes today. So yeah.
You need an award, Ray. You realize that I know film students who wouldn't have been committed so much to watch this movie.
Yeah.
You really did make it all the way through.
I didn't think I was going to, and every time, you know, this was another one where, like, I told people, because I got people at work who are like, what movies are you watching this week? And I'm like, oh, we're watching Lawrence of Arabia. And they're like, ooh. And I'm like, have you seen it? And they're like, no. Well, they're like, a lot of people were like, well, I tried and I made it like so long, but I didn't make it through the whole thing. Or I've seen parts of it, but not the whole thing. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm getting worried now. But a lot of people, especially younger people, said the same thing about, Gone with the Wind. So,
yeah, that's a long movie.
We don't get too many 3-4 hour epics, you know. So, Jeff, are you saying that you're going to be really mad at me if I put like War and Peace on here, or?
Well, let's see. Spread it out.
That's only 8 hours.
I think we could. I think I could handle that.
Yeah,
okay. But you know, spread it out and warn me about the length. I didn't realize how long this movie was.
I didn't realize how long it was until I got the DVD from Netflix and it said 3 hours and 45 minutes, and I went, yeah.
Yeah. This morning I was thinking about ripping it as well, and I pop it in and it goes 3 hours and 45 minutes. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh damn, I need to start watching this movie.
It's also really notable because we act as we, you know, you both of you said, you know, like, modern audiences at the time weren't prepared for this kind of thing. You didn't have 3.5 hour movies, and that is somewhat of a British thing, meaning this movie was made in by a British director, and it's a very British cast, and it's a very British industry type of thing. They don't have the same impetus that us Hollywood folks have about getting movies in and making money. This was viewed, I mean, there's no such thing as a non-prestige British film, it seems, some days. They're all made for the joy of making them and for the joy of having them. So there really was no thought about, are people really going to sit down for 4 hours to watch this movie? Mm-hmm. Of course they are. We're making it. It's the only one we're making this year. We only make 5 movies a year. This is what we do. Right. So there's that. And little things like the overture and the intermission section and having part one and part two and just kind of going with it, all things that contemporary audiences back then would have had problems with, but they muscled their way through it because it was viewed as, in order to be an important, intelligent viewer, these are the kind of movies you were supposed to watch. You know, these were like War and Peace, you know, or like Ulysses, the James Joyce novel that no one finishes, but everyone claims to have started. You know, that's, it's interesting when you watch old movies to realize that they had different goals. and different viewing habits than we did. And that makes a big difference. It's not that people liked boring movies. It's that people didn't really care so much what the audience thought of the movie they were making. They figured if it's good, they'll watch it. If it's not good, they won't. We don't have to cater to their needs that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. The other thing that I kept thinking about, and it was one of the things, because obviously I got this through Netflix, and you have the choice of Blu-ray or DVD if they have them. So I just kind of took it for granted that because I automatically have mine set that if you have a Blu-ray, send me the Blu-ray. So I took it for granted, not checking, that I was going to get the Blu-ray. Well, there is no Blu-ray of this movie yet. I guess it's going to come out this summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. They're doing a very intense sort of remastering of it for Blu-ray.
Right. And honestly, I mean, the one thing obviously that strikes you, besides the fact that this movie is long, I think we've established that the movie is a long movie, is that almost every shot in this movie is just there to show the just epic scale of the desert and the journey and how big it is. And every shot's from like 2 miles away, and the people are like these little specks on camels. And I kept looking at it, and I'm watching it on my home theater, and I have lucky enough to have a projector, so I'm pushing like a 130-inch screen. But one of the things is, like, you know, I don't really know. I'm thinking about, like, I remember this being on television. And, you know, it was like a mini series thing. They had it split across 4 or 5 days. And I'm like, I can't imagine watching this on like a 21-inch television on standard def. Like, I couldn't imagine getting through it at all, because I'd be like, you couldn't see anything on that. Yeah. I mean, most of these with a 130-inch screen at DVD resolution, which nowadays isn't considered all that great. I mean, I was having some issues where I'm like, wow, this image is really muddy, and, you know, there's some detail that I don't think I'm picking up on. So I just think that there's a lot of it that was lost by not being able to see it in the theater. And I think the last time it was in the theater was in the 80s. It was re-released as some sort of anniversary. I'm really looking forward to seeing it on Blu-ray. If and when it finally comes out.
A lot of David Lean movies were this way. He was kind of a sucker for really beautiful cinematography. And again, this is also the time period where filmmakers are really stretching. Television has become popular, and there's a lot of competition that where there never was. So one of the ways that filmmakers try to stay competitive was they started shooting these big, wide films, and to the point where if you didn't see it at the movie theater, you totally lost it. And this is one of those movies that you need a huge screen to really appreciate. And that's why the Blu-ray is taking so long to do, because I think they went back to the original film stock and scanned it, because nothing since the film stock is appropriate for this. But it's a beautiful film. It kind of lulls you in its beautifulness, which is, you know, you were talking about Gone with the Wind. Gone with the Wind is a soap opera in many ways.
Right.
And so you're watching people bitch at each other all the time, and it's entertaining, so you don't mind it that it's 3 hours. But this movie, I remember there are sections of it where you're staring at desert, and you're supposed to just love the beauty and desolation of the desert. And then Omar Sharif appears in the middle of a mirage, you know, out of nowhere, like some figure, and Peter O'Toole's eyes are this brilliant sort of color at all times. Like, you're supposed to luxuriate in all this beautifulness. So no, if you're watching it on a 20-inch screen, you're wasting your time. You really do need to have this beautiful image, because otherwise, all it is a really, really nasty guy going around doing kind of unpleasant things for 3 hours. I mean, that's also a unique thing about Lawrence of Arabia. You know, he's an important figure in British history. You have a British filmmaker making this epic with him, and they make him such an incredibly horrible character. Like, you connect with him because he's obviously ravishing and riveting, but at the same time, you're like, he really likes killing that guy, and... Is he getting raped off screen? Is that what?
Right.
You know, that's sort of interesting as well.
The question that I kept playing through my head over and over again while I'm watching this is, and maybe this is tied to the fact that I picked up the Game of Thrones DVD or Blu-rays today, but I'm like, what is this? What is T.E. Lawrence's motivation, because, you know, they speak very briefly about how, you know, there are Englishmen who just love the desert and they come here and they fall in love and they don't want to leave. And I kept running through my head, like, what was his, why was he seem to be so involved in this conflict and trying to give these, it didn't seem like he particularly cared about the people that much. You know, he just seemed like, I'm going to help you guys reclaim your country, but without ever saying that. That was just seemed like his thing. But I'm like, what is he doing? And what kept coming back to in my head, and I don't even know if this is really true or not, but they have that one little scene where they talk about his father. And he's, you know, he says, my father's name is thus. And he goes, well, how come you don't have the same name as your father? Oh, my, you know, my father never married my mother. And to me, it almost struck me as like, I'm going to show them, I'm going to make my own mark, you know, even though I, you know, didn't have my father's name. This is my chance to sort of do something huge and stake my claim. Although at times he seemed at odds with that, like he didn't want to be the hero. He didn't want to be well known for what he was doing. So I just kept running through, like I kept trying to figure out, and he's just a pretty odd guy. It seemed like, you know, and in times, and I'm running through some points here, at times, you know, they talk about how flamboyant he was and how it was rumored that he was homosexual. I honestly do not know a whole lot about him. I'm not that well read in any of his stuff. So, you know, this is really my first sort of really foray into his history. And again, watching a film about somebody, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt because a lot of it's, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are all kind of why the movie holds so much power even 50 years after it was made, because no one really knows what T.A. Lawrence's life was like. He was, at the time even, people didn't really know. So the film kind of presents that paradox. Mm-hmm. Is he really trying to save Arabia for Arabians, or is he working the British way? And I remember that there is actually a pivotal scene in it where he asks them, and he asks his British commanders if they have plans for Arabia, and they kind of hedge it a little bit, and they don't answer him. And I remember the first time I watched it, I'm like, the history's pretty clear that the Britain wanted Arabia for himself, but why aren't they just saying that? And throughout the entire movie, though, they keep that element of mystery around, and it makes for a really captivating character, but it leaves you with so many questions. And that's also unusual in comparison to current movies, where I can't imagine an epic of this level where we would not know if we liked the guy or not. I mean, like that, it's like when Sonnenberg did the 5-hour Che that no one's ever seen. It's very rare now to see movies that are this sort of morally complicated and still work. And I think it does still work if you commit to it.
Yeah, I was having a really tough time with probably the first hour of this movie. Once he sort of, I won't say got comfortable, but once he sort of became more indoctrinated with, you know, the Arab culture that he was traveling with, and things sort of started happening, that's when I started to sort of get pulled and sucked into the sort of complexities of him, you know, watching him sort of change. And I honestly didn't get a whole lot of like the fact that he enjoyed killing. I more came off like he was very confused by it. Maybe he did enjoy it, but he was completely confused by it. It seemed like once he had to execute his friend, for lack of a better term, that he spent so much time and effort to go back and save, that even before the whole Turkish prison rape scene, he seemed to be fundamentally changed from that act. Like, you know, that he was somewhat shattered, not completely, but just didn't really know what to do with himself from that point on. And I had heard the rumors about him being gay, but the whole, like, you know, they're talking about, you know, oh, he took the two young Arab boys as his, you know.
Yeah, I always thought that was so random. He took them and then they died, and it's like, wait, what? Like, why were they even around? If they were right. Just gonna set up, like, dude, does he need people around him to die to prove a point?
Right, they were his red shirts. I don't know.
Yeah,
So yeah, there's some weird things going on there, and but I mean, overall, the biggest thing that I kept running through my head while I'm watching this was, there's a lot of this movie, not that I would necessarily cut, but I would have approached it like, this would be a good time to do the Indiana Jones map travel from point to point. Like, yeah, there's really not a whole lot going on here other than
by map.
Yeah, other than this really beautiful scenery, which he seems to be, I want to show these guys traveling through this beautiful scenery. It's like, you know, I get that it's beautiful, and I think I can come away with that impression, and cut out a lot of stuff in the middle.
There's also looking at it at a slightly different perspective. Sure, it was beautiful scenes, but he could also be trying to emphasize to you that this was a really long journey, and you are taking the long journey with us.
Right.
So it wasn't. So yeah, he was trying to display this beautiful desert scenery, but also he was trying to give you this perspective.
Well, it's funny because there's a little trivia item here where I guess Peter O'Toole went on the Tonight Show in the 70s, and he was talking to Johnny Carson about how long the movie took to make. So he goes, you know, there's a scene where T.E. Lawrence and General Allenby are at a meeting, and they continue walking and they go down a staircase. And he goes, according to O'Toole, part of the scene had to be reshot much later. He goes, so in the final print, when I get to the bottom of the stairs, I'm a year older than I was when I started walking down them. Yeah, like literally a year older.
It's also something that that we haven't talked about, which when I was watching parts of the movie that I did get to watch from recasting from when I saw it years and years ago. I remember mentioning it years and years ago and noticing again. Now, Claude Rains often ended up playing parts like the one he played. He's Claude Rains always also ended up being the guy in Casablanca. He always ended up playing sort of the Mediterranean guy. And Omar Sharif, this was his sort of big Middle Eastern role. After that, he became obviously very famous. And Peter O'Toole was somewhat of a nobody when he was cast, but he's playing T.A. Lawrence. But all the other people, one, there are no women.
Yes,
and there feels like there's not enough actual Middle Eastern people in these parts. So yes, but it's never mentioned really. And even as part of the criticism of the movie, no one ever really talks about that. They acknowledge that this is a very British film, and that's just how it's going to be. But it's hard to watch it now and go, is this the story of Arabian independence, or is this a story of what is the story here, and hence who should be telling it? And also, I always thought that when people start talking about Avatar and about Fern Gully and Last of the Mohicans, about this whole going native thing, I mean, Lawrence of Arabia really is the first going native movie. It's the first movie where someone goes to the wild barbarian lands and is worried that he might be transformed by it, you know. So that it's notable as being one of the first stories that dealt with that aspect. And it's fun that you watch the movie now and you still see that, and you see that we still have those questions about who am I and am I really changed by what's around me? Does it matter what food I eat or which well I drink from? Does it totally change who I am?
And you know, this was another one of the movies that it opened. You know, well, obviously he's a historical character, so people that are familiar with him are going to know what happened to him, and so there's really no spoilers. But again, I'm not that familiar with him. I mean, I'd heard of him. I knew he was an author. You know, I'd heard of this movie and the things that he did, but I'd never watched it. And again, it opens with his death, you know, so I'm kind of like, okay. You know, it's like I understand sometimes why they do that, but for me, that was just kind of like, it made it a little harder to get into.
The Citizen Kane it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that again I think it's the movie was made for was moved at a period by a group of people where they were making a movie about someone who one I think was still alive at the time in 62. I think he might have either just died or been alive or was still very late alive. Actually, I can just look that up. And also someone who for a lot of people, was a well-known figure. He had been dead 30 years when they made the movie. He died 30 years before the movie was made. So this is someone that people that folks in Britain were still kind of aware of as a historical figure. So that's probably why they didn't feel like they were giving anything away by talking about his death.
Right. Right. I understand that. That is made for people that are probably much more aware of his life and exploits than me.
Sure. But it is annoying. I do understand. I get a little irritated sometimes because I don't like framing stories. It's like, oh, we're going to sit around and talk about what this guy did. Isn't that great? It doesn't really fill me with a lot of urgency. I feel like I'm just, you know, especially in this movie where, as far as I remember, they never come back to that. Like, you don't go back to the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like,
why? No, it just ends.
Yeah, so why do we even need this group of old people talking about who he was? Unless you wanted to, unless I guess the theme is, was he Lawrence of Arabia or Lawrence of Britain? Like, who was he? And but I in this case, I think you can cut away with that first 5 minutes without really losing anything.
Mm-hmm. And I also very much enjoyed the first person camel shot. So. I was like, on the big screen, I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. And I'm trying to think of, like, I'm like, what's the oldest movie that I can recall that had, like, just a strictly first-person perspective shot like that? And that's
a great question.
This might be one of the oldest ones I can recall having that. Of course, I haven't seen every movie ever made, so I could very well be wrong. But, yeah, that was, like, one of the few parts that I'm like, okay, I'm into this. We're, like, actually getting some action here. We got first-person camera. I'm like, woohoo! First-person camel! It's playing on my first-person shooter sensibilities, you know?
I was like, going to say, I didn't realize you had a hard-on for first-person camera.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it just sort of struck me with all the sort of very methodical shots and cinematography. It just sort of stuck out. Like, it didn't seem to fit with the rest of the film. That's why I was like, okay.
But that being said, it's nowhere near as good as the first person camera as in Doom.
Awesome. There you go.
That was awesome.
Yes. Well, you know, it didn't have the head weaving motion in it, you know.
God, I've gotten so used to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know what else to say other than, I mean, if you guys want to talk about this, the Omar Sharif quote cracked me up. When I see epic movies like this or movies that have sort of, obviously this had a huge, was it 91% or 98% critic rating. I will go to some critic pages after I've watched it. I don't do it before I've watched it. And just sort of read to see what they've had to say about the film. Because, you know what, I don't always look at things with the same sort of eyes these guys. Like, I don't pick up on a lot of the nuances. I'm like, I want to see what, you know, Roger Ebert had to say about the film. But one of the first things that's in his review is he talks about this quote from Omar Sharif, which just cracked me up, which is, I don't know when this interview was from or where this was pulled from, but basically this quote says, and they're talking about, you know, somebody coming to you with an idea for this movie. If you are the man with the money and somebody comes to you and says he wants to make a film that's 4 hours long, no stars, no women, no love story, not a whole lot of action, and he wants to spend a huge amount of money to go film it in the desert, what would you say? And I know there's a trivia item where it says, I think Spielberg, and I don't know how old the trivia item is, but he said that if you were going to make this movie today, it would cost you at least $280 some million to make. I can't imagine any studio these days spending that kind of money to make this movie.
No, I can totally see it. I'm going to go shoot a movie in the desert, and I want to get a Hulk. I mean, Ridley Scott tried to do this with
Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven, and, you know, CGI saved his ass because there's really, I mean, people think about, oh, everyone is used to spending $100-150 million in a movie, but that's a movie with, like, a lot of special effects, which is, you know, you're just paying people. But when you think about the rigors of having to shoot it on location, and we're talking on location in the 1960s in, like, Saudi Arabia, like, you know, it's amazing how expensive this movie goes. And again, goes to show that David Lean just kind of made the movie he wanted. And there really wasn't a lot of pressure saying, oh, it's too long, or, There's not enough women in it. It's like David Lean. You are the greatest British director of all time. You are still alive. You are still wonderful. Go send. Go take your people and cast who you want, and just go make your movie. You know, and I think that sometimes I get a little annoyed when people blast Cleopatra because, oh, who would ever spend so much money on this and that? It's a total waste of money. There are a lot of movies that cost a lot of money that were really good, and this is one of them. So, I mean, it is fun to talk about how it really can't be made now. There's just no way that someone would sit down and make this movie. Lord of the Rings probably is the closest I can find. But even then, they did such a job of trying to hedge their bets by saying, oh, we'll make three movies at the same time, and, you know, we'll get a discount on this, and we'll use all the same characters and, you know, make the sets, and, you know, we'll try to do this in a very controlled environment. But it's that, I think, would be the comparison between, you know, and the fun part is that both, after you see all three movies, are kind of the same, almost as long.
Yes. It's like, whoa, what did I just watch? Okay.
Right.
So. With that, what have we learned? We have learned that motorcycle equals wear a helmet.
Yeah.
The trick is not minding that it hurts. That big things so have many ways. Small beginnings.
Ooh.
A lot of double entendre in our what have we learned today.
Only two types of creatures have fun in the desert, Bedouins and gods. Dreaming won't get you to Damascus. Young people must say their say, but wise people must decide. Nothing is written. Life's a veil of troubles, and there may be honor among thieves, but none among politicians. And that's what we've learned from Lawrence of Arabia. Yet another long, epic movie. This movie suffers a lot from lag, from the intent to inspire the feeling of the long journeys through the desert and such. When it gets to the point, we have some good stuff, although at times I swear I had flashbacks to Priscilla. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a long movie. We've established that. And one of the strangest long movies, for the above reasons that I said, you know, no stars, no women, no love story, no action, really. To watch, but I still got into it. It was a struggle at first, but, you know, just kind of let it sort of take me on its little journey, or its long journey, sorry. So I think, though, and I'm totally with this, if you have an opportunity to watch this on some sort of large format, if you know somebody with a projector, and you have the time and the patience to watch it, go for it. I really, really want to rewatch this again, as crazy as it sounds, once the Blu-ray comes out. So,
yeah, and this is really the prototypical David Lean movie. It's long. It's intelligent. We didn't talk about it, but people speak beautifully in it. It's very male. It's very well acted. It's very, very long. You know, it's a British thing. They make these controversial historical figure movies. They show all the beauty and the depth. And if you buy it, it's beautiful. If it's not, it will just bore you to tears. You really should watch it at home when you have time on a beautiful screen, especially when the Blu-ray. And Peter O'Toole is just beautiful in it. We didn't mention that, but, you know, there is a gay reading of this film, and part of the gay reading is all about how pretty is Peter O'Toole, and isn't it wonderful how many people just stare at him and go, God, blonde, you're pretty.
Hair, blonde hair, blue eyes, clean, yeah, shaven, basically nothing that any of us would like. Moving on.
Much prettier than the real tea, you
are. Yes. Into the present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
The Secret World of Harry Eddy. I think I pronounced it right this time. 94% fresh, 88% audience. Directed by Hiromasa Honobashiyashi. To totally ruin that. With the voice featuring the voices of Bridget Mendler, Amy Poehler, and Will Arnett.
Yeah, and if you guys looked at all at the IMDb page for this movie, it's a mess because this movie was released, obviously, in Japan first, and then it was released in the UK, and then it came to the US. So there's like three actors listed for every character. It's sort of crazy. It's all mixed together into one giant IMDb reading. That being said, first thing I want to know, is anybody familiar with the source material?
I have heard of the books. I am. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. The genre that this book's the children's book about the really sick child. I mean, it's somewhat of a little bit of a genre.
Isn't that a ton of children's movies?
It is
Japan.
That in Japan especially, but A Little Princess, Secret Garden. If you're into really sick children, there's a genre of children's literature that's all about sick children, and so I'd heard about The Borrowers, but I had not read it.
Okay, I didn't know about it. I've heard of The Borrowers and this concept of the borrower, but I never knew about the sick child.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole concept of the little people that live in our world that we're unaware of, very common. You know, you've got obviously The Borrowers, which I think the book came out in the early 50s. There was a whole sequel series of books that came out about this one particular family that we see in this movie. But, I mean, you got things like The Smurfs. And I'm not talking about the horrible CG movie that just came out. you know, The Littles, Snorks, all those, like, you know, there's this magical world going on around us that we don't even pay any attention to. Sort of genre going on.
The Littles, that's where I was getting the uh-huh. this room.
Yeah,
it's the things the Littles see in my bedroom, the things mm-hmm. they see.
So we've established that. Has anybody seen the original Japanese film?
Nope. Nope.
Okay. I watched a little bit of it. I didn't watch all of it. I mainly watch it just for comparison's sake of the dub. Because of what little anime snobbery I do have is that I typically like to watch them in their original Japanese and watch them subtitled, because most dubbed anime has horrible voice acting in it. That being said, I didn't really mind the voice acting in this film at all. I had a few issues with some of the characters. I actually preferred the voice of the mother in the American version than I did to the Japanese, because for some reason the Japanese version made her sound like a schoolgirl. She had this really high-pitched, whiny voice that drove me crazy. I didn't watch the whole Japanese. I just wanted to kind of skim through it really quick for comparison. But they did a decent job with the dub. I was rather pleased with it. So if you're like me and are a sort of dub snob, don't worry about that. I think if anybody's performance was a little wooden for me, it was Will Arnett's.
No!
But it served his character.
Oh, I loved it so much because it gave me so many bad ideas. Yeah. It gave me so many horrible ideas. I mean, I loved that the character was this broad, very practical, pragmatic sort of super dad who mm-hmm. he just did stuff, he fixed things. But I love that he spoke with so lacking of emotion sometimes. Like, I feel bad. This podcast hasn't been anywhere near as dirty as it should have been, but I felt so bad watching because I kept imagining, like, what's it like when he has sex with that voice? Because one, it's a Will Arnett thing for me always. Will Arnett always talks like he's about to do things to your backside. I mean, that's just kind of his thing, and you're kind of frightened at all times about what he might have in his hands. But you know, but when he's doing the voice of this dad and he's so gentle and nice, I kept wondering how he flips. Like in my head, I kept hearing him say, "Woman, impregnate yourself with my staff." I was like, that's what he would do, right? Like, he wouldn't reach over and actually touch her. He'd just sort of announce his intention. And things would just happen. But I do agree with you, because often the dub is horrible. In this case, Amy Poehler and Mark Warnett are really fantastic at what they do. The mother took some getting used to, because I thought she was kind of a unknowing character, but I eventually bought her, and I enjoyed the fun things that Amy Poehler was doing with her. But it was surprisingly, and the kid looked like he might have, you know, might have been on Valium at all times, but eventually that I got into that sort of like, this is, hello, I'm not going to hurt you. That took some getting used to, but the like other parts of the movie, it sucks you in once you sort of let it go at its pace.
Yeah, and I'm sort of glad that they let it. I mean, as far as the story goes, that they let it sort of go in the direction that it went. It really I'm glad that it's sort of focused on this one family that sort of thought they were on their own, and it was more about the girl's sort of journey of discovery of this world that she, you know, she knew existed outside of her little, you know, little home inside the walls of this house. And obviously she had been, you know, going out and exploring, much to the chagrin of her family, and grabbing things and bringing them back. But just to see the sort of wonder as she goes into these places in the house that she'd never been before. And she's just like, wow, this is like, what goes on here? Like the wonder in the character was really well done. And thankfully the voice acting pulled it off, because it could have really lost me if it didn't pull it off, you know?
Yeah. My first thought when I saw it, when I was watching it, was this is incredibly well directed in the sense that it is incredibly focused on creating a feeling. It knows what feeling it wants. From the moment when she like turns around and looks, when she climbs up on the roof and she turns around and sees it all, from the moment when she sees the kitchen for the first time. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of very small details that were added to give you a picture of how this little character sees this larger world. Mm-hmm. And that was really effective. I think the decision to paint all the backgrounds was really great. That's something that a lot of films now wouldn't do for expense reason or for taste reasons or aesthetic reasons. But it really created a very beautiful world. I mean, I wanted to visit this country home and like lay on the grass with all these painted flowers around. I mean, it was surprisingly beautiful in a understated, leisurely way, which again, you know, if this was a Pixar movie, it'd all be candy colored. You know, if it was a DreamWorks movie, it would be all very garishly bright. And here they kind of was this pastel muted color was everything. And that was sort of a very nice touch, but it's a sign that they knew what they wanted this movie to be, and they kept it at that. And it's a very Studio Ghibli thing, you know, to create this world that's beautiful that you want to spend time in. Here it's unique because it's not really that special of a world, but the perspective makes it special. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't care about kitchens. I'm not that kind of gay. But I was really aware of how mesmerizing it must have been for her to go through that scene where her father's leading her for her first borrowing, and they're using nails as stairways, and there's a comb. There's a lot of these little details where you're like, this world is really interesting, and then they open the door and you're like, it's just a kitchen, but it's this glorious kitchen. And I don't know why people don't just eat sugar in cubes now. They should just I love that it's this perfect little cube. I want to hold it and look at it. That I mean, the movie does such a good job of making you view things in the different perspective that I wanted to go and look at my kitchen and actually look at the little details of it. It's very nicely done in that way.
Yeah, well, I've always sort of said that Studio Ghibli films, it's like if you were able to live inside a watercolor painting, you know, if that's what it would be like. But I love, again, I agree with you. I loved the attention to detail. I loved the fact that you could tell that there was a surface tension on the water.
Yeah,
like the fact that you're looking at a piece of scotch tape that you're essentially magnifying this small piece of tape that you're able to see the adhesive.
Oh, that's what that was. I was wondering what that was, and that makes total sense.
Yes. You know, that shows to me, I'm like, wow, that's really paying attention to details. If you were to take a piece of scotch tape and look at it under a microscope and pull it apart really slowly, it's exactly what you would see. You know, it's all those little things that you don't see at our scale of things. That they really took the time to go, okay, what would this look like? What would be going on? You know, and I totally, the first time I saw like a droplet of water act the way it did, I was like, I'm going to be completely happy with this because they've got it down to that little stupid level of detail that the water would actually behave differently at this level. So I was really impressed with it from that. And then I could just allow myself to put all my guards down and just sort of enjoy. Like I wasn't going to get hung up on, you know, little things like, cause I, unfortunately with my type of brain, sometimes little things like that, if they don't go the way I expect them to go, it can really do a lot to pull me out of a film. So when I see that the filmmakers cared enough to actually put that level of detail in it, I immediately just sort of go, okay, I trust them now enough to like, just take me wherever they want to go.
Yeah. I mean, I normally get annoyed when people create software programs and algorithms to map the way water works. Mm-hmm. But when someone draws, like when there's a scene where she takes the leaf as an umbrella and runs mm-hmm. outside, and mm-hmm. when you come back, there are droplets of water on her body. Something mm-hmm. like that wasn't like there's no computer doing the algorithm for that. That's someone actually drew oh. each one of those little buttons, and then she brushes them off. And I'm like, wait, isn't she wet? And then I realized, no. wait, she's too small to get wet. And mm-hmm. that part really sort of made me realize that. And the fact that not for me, attention to detail differs. I mean, sometimes you get animated, like digitally animated films, that attention to detail means that it's super high resolution, and then you get attention to detail, like someone thought to draw this here for a mm-hmm. particular reason, and I appreciate. I think you did see that care, and it's a little moment, like there's no part of the story that requires us to know that she doesn't get wet by just no droplets of rain, but right. it's this bit that lets you, that makes the world feel real to them in a way that it wouldn't have been if they just let a computer pump out all the pixels.
Well, I think they do a good job of constantly reminding you, because sometimes, you know, you sort of forget, especially when they're in their house, you forget that they're these little tiny people, you know, like, because to scale, you could be normal sized. So there's always these little tiny things that help remind you that these people are very small. And they did a really good job of injecting that without beating you over the head with it. So I really sort of appreciate that. And that's the other thing. When you watch a movie like this, you have to, you know, it's a lot of people don't realize, because we see so many CG animated movies. Not that CG animated movies aren't hard to make and don't take a level of artistry, but when you have to realize that every frame of animation that you are seeing in this film is hand drawn by a person, it's sort of, you kind of sit there and go, wow, you know. So every, you know, how many frames a second, 24 frames a second, how many frames of animation that somebody has to sit there and draw or paint. It really just sort of blows your mind. And that's kind of why I put this thing, you know, Disney's obviously, you know, forged this relationship with Studio Ghibli, and they bring their films over here. Why do you think that, like, a studio like Disney doesn't do more of its own traditional hand-drawn animation like it used to?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, I think it's a focus thing. I mean, it's a type of filmmaking. For me, there's no value between hand-drawn animation or CG animation. There's no value difference. It's just a different mm-hmm. type of animation.
Right.
I do believe that it's an audience thing. I think people want the gizmo factor of the computer-drawn. I think mm-hmm. that's kind of the main reason.
Mm-hmm. I, for some reason, I think it's for very much it's a cultural thing, because I don't believe, you know, there's obviously this sort of perception that anything animated, whether it be computer animated or hand-drawn animation, that any movie that's animation is meant for children. That wow. it's immediately meant for children. And I think there's a perception issue here in America, and that's one of the things they fight. And especially, you've got a Disney film, Disney animated film, obviously for kids. Not that I'm saying Disney's going to bring over, like, Yorizuki Doji or anything. Not worried about that. But I think that's one of the things. And I think a lot of people in America sort of take for granted the amount of work that goes into making an animated film.
Oh, I think you're right, because obviously Miyazaki. Everyone in Japan knows who that is. Mm. We don't know of an animator since Disney. You know, we don't. Right. There are no superstar animators. There's no one who come out to a film. Even now, all the great animation film directors, Brad Bird, Andrew Stanton. Andrew Stanton's doing John of Mars. Brad mm-hmm. Bird did Mission Impossible 4. You know, and you know they're doing all those movies. So there isn't a lot of energy and a focus on, oh, you're a beautiful, amazing animator, release a piece of work for us that we can appreciate. Right. So there is that interest. I do believe that it's also the fact that, like you said, that it's a cultural thing. Animation is not viewed as a children's genre in Japan, and so hence they can continue to make animated films without any sense of, oh, you're doing it for the kids, or you can't move on in your career because all you're doing is children's movie. Whereas here, people get started as animators and then quickly find some way of getting a job and keeping a job that is an animation. Obviously, John Lasseter is a great example of someone who outgrew animation and now does a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is a little off topic, but if I ever I have to find it, my friend Sean, who is much more of an anime animation connoisseur than I am, he wrote an amazing article about the state of animation in Japan and how it's even in Japan, it's sort of a struggling industry. How it's beginning to die out just because of the sheer amount of money needed to keep it going. Yeah. And so, you know, that's one of the things is like, I really don't know how much longer we're going to see films like this to continue to come out.
Yeah, especially since you do need an entire village to make it happen. I mean, you need lead animators, you need the people who do the in-between key animation stuff, you know, and also you need an entire infrastructure to teach these people what to do and how to do it, and they all have to work on films before they can do films on their own. So this isn't something where, you know, this is the last hand-drawn animated film. We can't do 10 years from now, someone's like, oh, hey, let's do a hand-animated film now. They're like, we can't. There's no one around that can do it, so we can't do it. Even if we wanted to, there isn't anybody who can do it. It's going to take another generation of people to learn how to do it before we'd ever see it again.
Right, exactly. You know,
and is that a shame? It's a shame because we're losing an animation. But like I said, I don't see that there's – for me, there's value in it because it's – a very distinct art form, but I don't think that animated films that are hand-drawn teach us, show us, provide us something that digitally animated films don't show us. Right. I do feel like it's as if we stop doing mystery novels tomorrow. Well, I'll hate that we don't do mystery novels, but I won't feel like we've lost something as a culture because we don't have this type of art anymore.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that it's hard for, us as Americans to sort of grasp is like a typically animated, just like a television show in Japan, when they go on sale, I mean, those discs will sell for, you know, we'll get a full season of a show for, you know, $30, $40. They will spend $250, $300, $400 sometimes on a couple episodes.
Damn,
because that's what really finances the show. The shows are sort of relegated to, you know, like the spot on television where is relegated to infomercials here.
Yeah,
that's where a lot of anime is shown on in Japan, mainly because it's the cheapest time for the studios that are working on these things to actually afford to buy time to put them on. So they buy blocks of time and put a show on for as long as they can afford to do it, and then try to recoup some of that money by selling, you know, a couple episodes for, you know, a couple $100. Yeah. So it's definitely a struggling industry and a struggling art form. So, you know, I love being able to see a movie like this in America on a big screen. You know, I know that I'll be able to see it eventually on DVD or Blu-ray, but to be able to actually see it on a big screen in a theater, to me, it's not something that you get to do all the time.
Was there anybody in your theater?
I didn't think there was going to be anybody. For one, it was really hard for me to find a showing of this after 2:30 in the afternoon. There was only one theater by me that was playing any shows, and I got to it. It was a 6:45 show, and I was the only one in the theater until right when the movie started, and then another older gentleman came in, and then another two or three people came in maybe about 15 minutes after it started. So there's about five or six people.
I saw it in Evanston, which is a college town, and I saw it at a 6:50 show at the main theater in this college town. It's like a 12-seat theater, and there was one somewhat middle-aged woman. I kind of pegged her as like a university professor or some sort of administrator, and there was just me and her. And this, but it was also in the smallest theater of the smallest screen of the theater. It's like 50 seats. You know, it's usually where the things go when right before they get pushed off. So I haven't looked at box office, but I'm wondering how Disney is doing. How much did it make any money on the film itself?
Yeah, I haven't looked at any box office results yet. So, I mean, I can't remember how long is it? Has it only been out for two weekends or is it one weekend? I think it's two. I think this is the second weekend it was out.
U.S. release day was on the 17th of February.
Okay, so it's been out a while.
Well, yeah. The domestic total is $17 million.
Okay.
But for it, it's already made $126 million.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure it's done a pretty good amount of business worldwide. Yeah. Yeah, I did find the link to Sean's article, and it is public on Google+. So if you get a chance,
I'd love check to read it out. I would like to read that because I'm always curious. It's kind of sad that, you know, a citizen has to do the work to sort of document a dying of an industry. But I know enough about academia that they probably no one's really writing about Japanese anime anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much.
So, what did we learn from the secret of Arrietty?
Mm-hmm.
Children are more vicious than grown-ups. Borrowers only take what they need, and you can't live a life built on nothing but wishes. So what can I say? All these types of movies are just such charm to them. I can't help myself but to enjoy the movie. Go see it in the theaters. This is the type of storytelling I think we need to support.
And it's a Studio Ghibli Miyazaki film. And I didn't really touch on this too much. Miyazaki's able to take stories, and it seems like he breathes this life into them. And I know it's not just him. There's this whole studio of people working. But to me, it's this combination. And especially in this film, it resonated a lot for me that there was this combination of sort of whimsical, but also there was like just this overtone of like sadness. Like, and I don't know if that just had to do with the sick kid part of it. But there just seemed to be this overhanging emotion of not quite as happy as everything in this world could be. I swear to God, it's like the man just purely, he ejaculates color right onto film. That's the best way I could describe it. And it just warms my heart that I get to see animation like this in an American theater. So me, because I want to see more things like this in the theater, I recommend that you go. That's my recommendation.
Yeah. Now, some folks are going to love Studio Ghibli no matter what they actually do, and either because it's a reaction against the films that we see here in America or because they really like it. But in most cases, it's very well deserved, the acclaim that they get. They tell stories in a way that no one else does. Unlike previous films, you don't really get this weird, crazy world that you're awash in, but that makes it a little bit better because you get to see a very intimate, family-oriented world in a unique way. What does work is the beauty of the painted backgrounds, the voice acting, and also the core idea of how a friendship between two very different people can grow and happen and provide. Sometimes I thought it was a little too sort of pristine in some way. I felt like it was this little cute fairy tale kind of bit, and I wanted there to be a little bit more. We didn't talk about Hava, the housekeeper. I kind of hated her.
Carol Burnett.
She doesn't fit in the film, though. I mean, she's a character that doesn't really fit in the film, and she's kind of there just to make the plot go. And that ends up being a bit of a problem. But again, even if you're only doing it out of, I won't say pity, but out of respect, this is the kind of films that you should be seeing, because once they're gone, there isn't going to be anyone around that's going to start making them again.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not anytime soon, anyway.
Moving on into the future.
Hi. Welcome to the future. And I'm telling you, it's great here.
Well, John dies at the end.
Spoiler alert.
Release date unknown, but apparently will be at South By. Directed by Don Coscarelli. Coscarelli.
Yeah. Say that five times fast.
Starring Chase Williamson, Rob Mays, and Paul Giamatti. It's a drug that promises an out-of-body experience with each hit. On the street, they call it soy sauce. And users drift across time and dimensions. But some who come back are no longer human. Suddenly, a silent, otherworldly evasion is underway, and mankind needs a hero. What it gets instead is John and David, a pair of college dropouts who barely hold down jobs. Can these two stop the uncanny horror in time to save humanity? No. No, they can't.
All right, so a little bit of history about this. I guess this was the author wrote this, and it was published on the web as a story. It somehow then became a manuscript circa 2007, then evolved into a novel, and is now the novel, the rights to the novel have been purchased, and it's obviously become a film. But I guess they haven't found a distributor, or, you know, the logistics of film distribution have not been completely worked out yet. And I don't remember where I saw this trailer somewhere. I may have seen it in a theater. I don't remember. I saw it quite a while ago. And I just remember typing in on my phone, you know, like, oh, I got to put this on the list sometime to look. And I just kind of forgot about it. And then I think it came up again on my iPhone going through the trailers app, and I was like, oh, I definitely have to put this on the list. When I saw this trailer for the first time, I got this really weird sort of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas meets like some sort of comedy horror flick vibe, which kind of intrigued me a bit, because I don't know if you guys have seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and a lot of times with that movie and that person in particular, you're either a fan and you kind of get it and just sort of enjoy it, or you just don't get it and it makes absolutely no sense to you. I am one of the people that sort of, I can kind of roll with that kind of movie and like it and enjoy it for what it is, the sort of absurdity of it all.
Yeah, except that, I mean, this one, I don't think this is right on. This is, I think, going to be more like a Boba Hope Tap thing. You know, I think this is going to be more. I mean, the guy who directed it, I knew him from Phantasm, but I now learned he also did Boba Hope Tap, and now I kind of understand. What I didn't like about Boba Hope Tap, which is a movie that I hated, but anyway, is that it was neat. There was nothing really interesting that was going on. Like, we were supposed to be in it because, oh, it's Elvis and it's Mr. Chin guy, you know, but otherwise we don't care. What's different about this one is that it's compelling. You really do want to know what's going on. You are really curious. You got two characters that you can immediately connect with because they're basically teenage nerd slackers. And I love the trailer presents it as, we're telling you pieces of the story and you're hooked at some point. And the trailer does, one, it's an amazing trailer. I have yet to see a trailer that is so, it so much makes me want to see this movie because I am titillated and I'm curious and I'm excited and I don't know anything. It does a really good job of that, you know, of it. At some point, the movie, the trailer even sets itself up that way where at the end where he's like, okay, you have my attention. It's like, oh, that's not even the best part yet. And like, I love that drawing me in sort of bit about that. But it's, I mean, compelling story. I love the opening visual with you're slowly going down the snow field and he's hitting something with a hammer or an axe, and there's that voiceover. It kind of feels like Fargo, kind of feels like Blood Simple, kind of feels like, you know, something P.T. Anderson might have done. It looks like There Will Be Blood, and it looks, and this doesn't mean that this is what the movie's going to be about, but it has a visual flair to it that Boba Hope Tet didn't have, Phantasm didn't have, that, and Fear of Loathing didn't really have, you know. It's almost like Brazil in the level of like, something's happening. Let's go look at it.
Oh God, there's sure a movie I need to put on the list. Yeah, I mean, you pretty much summed it up the same way that I was feeling. I mean, from the second the trailer started and I saw the you know, that zoom in scene from the snow field, I'm like, okay, is he killing somebody? What is he doing? Like, what's going on? You know, that immediately hooks me to figure out what the heck. And then you've just got this like little series of images that every time you're like, ooh, what's that about? Ooh, that looks interesting. Ooh, what's going on there? But you don't know how it all relates to itself. And you're left there kind of going, okay, I have to see it just to figure out what the heck I just watched.
And like, also part of, part of the Studio Ghibli thing, you know, if we talk about we should support movies because they are unusual, what about this? You know, the story, the guy writes a web series. The web series ends up getting him a job on crack.com where he's a fantastic writer on there. And, you know, and then slowly this gets made and there are trailers out on the internet for it, but there's no distributor yet. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's kind of fun. If you're someone who rails against Hollywood or, you know, everything has to be this huge summer franchise, here's a little movie that could be interesting, could be horrible, but let's go see it.
Right. Exactly. It's just a bizarre little thing that, and if you really want to grab me, one of the things you can do is just be sort of bizarre, not for bizarre sake, but be bizarre and be sort of like you're like you said, you're titillating me. I want to know what's going on, basically. If you're able to push that button with me, then I'm like, I want to see it. I want to know what's, even if it's not at the theater, like this is definitely a movie that I would be like, when's it going to be on Netflix? When's it going to be, you know, because obviously with a movie like this, you never know if it's going to go ever into wide release. You know, may not hit, you know, a theater near me, or, you know, even being in a, I ran into this problem with, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. On its supposed release date, I could not find a theater within 100 miles of Chicago that had the frickin' movie to see. So, yeah. So, I don't know when I'm going to see this film. It may be in the theaters, may not be, but I will at some point see this movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about you, Jeff?
Yeah. I'll just leave my assessment for our excitement here because, yeah.
Okay.
So
also, Paul Giamatti's in it. Oh, my God. Yay for Paul Giamatti movies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's not too bad. So we're running a little long here.
Go ahead.
So with my excitement, after watching this trailer, I was like, wait, what just happened? Okay. Well, it could be good with Paul Giamatti and all, but seriously, I felt like I must have been on some of this soy sauce stuff or something. I'll just give it a meh.
Mm-hmm. It grabbed me from the second. Paul Giamatti, he's one of my favorite sort of actors ever since Private Parts. I've been a really big fan of his.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yes.
Pig vomit.
Pig vomit. So ever since then, I've been a big Giamatti fan. And then it shows me, you know, hey, it's from the creators of Phantasm and Bubba Hotep. And I know a lot of people hate Bubba Hotep. I don't know what it is about that movie that I just enjoyed. I don't know if it's just the fact that I love Bruce Campbell that was able to carry me through it. Not that he was particularly good in that movie, but so just that alone, before the trailer even gets going, really, had me. So yeah, I'm gonna see it eventually. I just don't know if I'm gonna be able to see it in the theater or see it at home.
Good times.
Nope.
Carlos?
Oh, I'm sorry, I spaced out. It's Paul Giamatti's in it. It's about drugs. There's crazy stuff. There's some weird makeup stuff that's happening. There's just stuff in this movie that you're wondering how it fits together, and it gives at least the indication that it does fit together. Also, it's a book. It's not something that people are just throwing together for the sake of it, aka Scary Movie. You know, it's a nice story up behind it. The crack.com guys have really sort of inspired me to believe that they write good stories. You know, and also it's a film that did well at festivals, that is shopping around for a distributor. But, you know, clearly they've gotten far enough and long that they put out a trailer for it. You know, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, when you're not doing Avengers Crazy or the Batman, whatever the new one's called that I don't remember anymore. You know, when you're not thinking of huge event movies that you wait, it's like a surprise. Movie comes out of nowhere and shocks you, you go see it, you know. Hopefully it'll be on the same level as Scott Pilgrim and I'll be just fine, happy and fine.
There you go.
Excellent. So coming to attractions next week, we've got In the Past, Crimes of the Heart, In the Present, John Carter, and In the Future, Intruders. There are plenty of ways to contact us. Pop over to our website, colmovies.com. Also, you can shoot us an email at colmovies@gmail.com. leave us a voicemail. We'd love to hear your voice. We'll play it on the show. It's 361-265-8255. That's 361-COL-TALK. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/COLmovies, Facebook at facebook.com/COLmovies. And despite that the link is not working yet, please pop over to iTunes, leave us a 5-star review. With that, any final thoughts?
I'm going to be heading to Texas next week, y'all. So I'll see you down there.
I am also heading to Texas next week, so I'll see y'all down there as well.
Nice. And I'm already in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, for Fuzz, for Carlos, take care, everyone.
Hasta la vista, baby.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
That'll do, kid.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.
He's looking at you, kid.
All right.